I think we can pretty reasonably say that we've properly established the wisdom of not judging a book by its cover. But there is one bit of prejudice that I am going to happily fess up to. I judge products, publications, and people by the typeface they use. A well-chosen font on a shop frontage will lure me in. Sloppy typography will have me disregarding a document out of hand. And I'm not alone. Font snobbery and fiercely held views on the business of lettering are definitely a thing. Gemma O'Brien's a Sydney-based visual artist who specialises in handwritten lettering and type design. And Stephen Banham is a typography expert and founder of the Letterbox Studio in Melbourne. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So, Stephen, why fonts? Why do we debate them in such a heated fashion?
Because they're an extension of our language and they're an extension of our culture, so therefore they're an extension of us. And they are very much the voice, they are the visual voice that we see every single day. So they are an intrinsic part of living.
People feel surprisingly heated about it, though, and everyone seems to have an opinion on what best font, worst font, serif, sans serif, and, you know, people are very invested in this.
They are. And that again, is because we're not just talking about an abstract thing here. We're talking about something that actually speaks of us as a culture. And it is fantastic that we're finally having these discussions, because I can assure you, having been around in this kind of field for about 25 years, the past 10 years has seen an extraordinary sort of mainstreaming of interest in typography, which is why we have shows like this.
So what's that about? Because let's face it, this is a craft that's as old as the printing press. Why is it that we're seeing this kind of renaissance of discussion and awareness of typography?
I guess at the absolute essence of this is a shift in the technology, of course, because it actually has moved from a trade-based concern, like printers and type designers, into something that I guess everybody has access to, the font menus on their computers. And also I think there's a much wider acknowledgement of the power of graphic design in everybody's life. So that when you look at the trends in typography, and each year there are specific trends in typography, they very, very closely follow the trends in branding and other larger kind of cultural themes.
Gemma O'Brien, you're a designer and illustrator, and a font designer in particular. What piqued your interest about going into font design?
I guess, you know, I was studying design at university, and typography was something that I kind of approached initially in the letterpress studio. So setting type by hand with one of my tutors. And at that point, it was something that was physical. So all the rules I'd previously learned about typography and design had been confined to the computer. So as soon as it was something that was hands-on and you're physically touching these metal letter forms and spaces are even made up of a square form, it all kind of made sense. And that was the starting point for me of really becoming interested in letter forms and the design of lettering and typography.
As far as an act of creation and design goes, it's one with fairly strict kind of confines or parameters, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, the appeal of the alphabet being limited to these kind of set shapes and, you know, it being legible but also being interesting and creative are really interesting kind of design constraints to work within.
So that passion of the creator when it comes to fonts is not a new thing. That's a historical thing. Stephen, I believe there's an extraordinary story about the Doves typeface in particular. Can you...
Well, that is one of many, many stories that come out of the whole culture of type. And there's some beautiful, sad stories, some very, very sort of poetic stories. But this one that you're referring to is to do with the Doves type, whereby a professional breakup between two particular parties meant that one particular person ended up throwing into the Thames some... What was it? It was many, many, many pounds of type. So all this type was thrown into the river in 1913, I think it was.
So two people designed a typeface together, and in such acrimony when they parted ways in business terms, one of them decided that if they couldn't work together, no one deserved their typeface.
And it was a very laborious thing, because this particular person would have to go to the Thames every single night under the cover of darkness and actually pour this metal type into the river. And, of course, this became a sort of legendary story in amongst the sort of type nuts. And recently the type has actually been located and brought out and then actually resurrected as a contemporary typeface.
Is it all that? As a type expert, do you look at it and go, oh, thank God that was saved, or is it just... you know, one of those things.
I think the value of this is the story.
Yeah.
The story is beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
So who owns a typeface? I mean, in the days where you had to physically pour it into a river to get rid of it, it's a little bit different to deleting a preference file on a computer or whatever else. How much ownership does a designer have over the design of a typeface and the life of it after they're done?
You're talking from a legal point of view?
From a legal point of view, or even a moral point of view, if you like.
Well, certainly from a moral point of view, they have complete ownership over it, even though, of course, it does still, as Gemma was saying, it still pertains only to a particular set of alphabetic glyphs. But in terms of the legal aspect of things, there's not a great deal of protection for font designers because most of the time, the protection actually pertains only to the name of the typeface, which is why you can often buy those crazy CD-ROMs with, you know, 1,000 typefaces, and you'll have a typeface like Phil Sands instead of Gil Sands, and it'll look exactly the same. So all they're doing is trying to work around this ridiculous kind of loophole. So there's not an enormous amount of protection for the type designer. But having said that, we're entering the age of font subscription rather than font purchase. And that finally gives some protection to the font designer.
So, Gemma, as an artist and a designer, how do you know you've created something new when it comes to working with the typeface? Surely there's only so many permutations and combinations of a capital A, for example.
Of course. I mean, because there is such a rich history and tradition in typography and letterforms, you know, so many of the fonts we see in our drop-down menus on the computer have been around for so long, and yet they retain the meaning and the feeling that they need to create. So I think creating something new is really about the context and also, you know, the trends or what's popular at the time. For me personally, I like to take it into something beyond just typography and into more of the world of illustration and art. So whether it's adding detailing or patterning or illustration and kind of pushing the boundaries between these two worlds, for me, is the way I try to create unique kind of pieces.
And so that's why you go for that particular challenge of hand-designed font.
Yeah. Well, I think also working by hand and doing custom lettering allows for something beyond what fonts can often do, which is that level of customization that's usually unique to a logo design. So you might make the A slightly different to what would be occurring into a traditional font and kind of work within the context of a specific word rather than designing just the letter forms.
Stephen, how do the types of fonts differ depending on whether they're print or computer use? I mean, that shift must mean that the handwritten or the kind of artisanal, if you like, version of a typeface has a different currency now because it's about the physical rather than just on screen.
Yes, well, certainly in the early days, it was a very uncomfortable transition from print to screen. But now, of course, as screens are getting higher res and so forth, the sort of representation of type on screen is getting much, much better. But I would certainly say that there's an enormous broadening, I guess, of the sort of wider kind of typographic experience, which I guess is what Gemma is referring to. But I would say that I guess the hand lettering and everything that goes with it has, of course, become a very fashionable aspect to current typography. I would like to think that we've actually finally reached a peak hipster script, and that we're actually beginning to get into something that is actually a little less embellished and a little more worker man.
Everyone wants to call peak hipster, and it's just not happening. Mainly because the hipsters know that peak hipster happened years ago when I first got into it, so they're not interested in your pronouncements. But so, Stephen, do I take it from that statement you're more into an austere font? Are you Mr. kind of sans serif? You like no frills, no adornment?
No, well, it's kind of interesting because when you look at the trends in graphic design and type, they seem to oscillate from sort of minimalist to maximalist very, very quickly. And it's almost like there's no territory in the middle. So we do seem to be going through a very overly ornamental, maximalist kind of period at the moment. And invariably, it will swing back, as you said, to a more austere kind of aesthetic. But there should be more to this paradigm than just two extremes.
Never is, I don't think. It's always the pronouncement of the extreme. Gemma, do you have favourites yourself? Do you have ones that you look at and you wish you'd been involved in the creation of them?
I guess, you know, because so much of the work I do, I might use an existing font or I might start something from scratch. But I think in terms of the, you know, minimal or more decorative elements, it's also, you know, relative to where it's being used. You know, obviously in books, you want something that's readable and simpler. But, you know, in the world of fashion and music, you need something that speaks to the same feeling of the content as well.
Stephen, one of the things that I'm curious about with this is if I go to the drop-down menu in my word processor, there are literally dozens of fonts there in the menu, and I would use maybe two of them at a pinch if I'm feeling really creative and spicy. Who determines that those fonts should all be there? Are there kind of ways that it's understood that they are in common usage? Do people tally this stuff up?
They do, and of course the vast majority of the typefaces on your computer would have actually been shipped with that computer, so they are a pre-existing set of fonts. So Microsoft have their particular set of fonts, Apple do, for example. So in the early Apple period, of course, all of the typefaces were named after cities. So you had, you know, London, New York, San Francisco. So you can actually pick when these kind of families or sets of typefaces are produced for a particular computer software.
But, you know, to my eye, and clearly I'm not an expert in the field like you are, but the distinction between Lucida Console and Lucida Sans Unicode is incremental, like it's nothing. So why are these all on my computer? Is this just to give me the illusion of choice, or are these things that are commonly used by lay people in different areas?
I think the illusion of choice is actually a very interesting idea. I mean, I do agree that the vast majority of people wouldn't really know or even care about such nuances between the two typefaces. But if they were to print out the same paragraph in every single typeface on their font menu, they would have a look at that printed piece and they would hear a different voice on every single one of those pages. And that's what it's about, is voices. The voices inside your head, and I'm not talking on a sort of mentally ill kind of spectrum. I'm talking the actual voices that you hear very much pertain to the typeface that you're reading.
I love that idea. Does that function that way for you, Gemma? I mean, you've been involved in a range of projects from murals on gallery walls to CD covers to advertisements for supermarket chains. How do you use font to create voice or a particular mood or image for a client?
Yeah, well, the voice is, you know, it's a really good analogy because it's an immediate feeling. You don't necessarily look at a word and analyse the typography and think, what is this making me feel? It just happens instantly in the same way that you wear different clothes or you respond differently to colours and architecture. Typography and fonts work the same way. So depending on the domain or the client that you're working with, that's something that it's almost like the designers behind the scenes coming up, constructing almost this feeling.
So Stephen, I know you had a wish where you wanted to see greater artificial intelligence used in digital font design, where computer programs could give fonts a life of their own. Explain that concept to me, because that sounds like Terminator 5.
Well, to me, that seems the logical step ahead if we begin to move away from the kind of stylistic things that we've been talking about, if we start to get into the content of language and so on. And in the early 1990s, there were some really important experiments looking at random intelligence within typefaces. So if you typed a line of X's, each of those X's would look different. So it actually creates this extraordinary spectrum of experience. And I can't help but think that is actually where a really rich potential lies with this, is beginning to actually customise the experience even within an actual letter, let alone an entire font.
Well, that sounds extraordinary. So I have to ask, anytime a conversation about font happens, Comic Sans gets raised as pure evil in the world of fonts. Is that something you subscribe to? Is it really as bad as all that?
I think in some ways the Comic Sans and the arguments around Comic Sans have become every bit as cartoon as the typeface itself. So, I mean, there's a beautiful some metaphor there between the typeface and the discussion around it, but it certainly is the kind of piñata of typography. There's no doubt about it. Everybody wants to have a go at it. But I think there is a more serious aspect to this sort of Comic Sans hatred.
Oh, it's just discrimination. It's awful. Gemma, are you tempted to kind of rehabilitate it artistically? Comic Sans with bells on, or is that beyond your practice?
I mean, I don't think that, you know, Comic Sans is inherently bad. I think it's, you know, things gain their meaning through use or overuse or misuse. And that, I think, is what potentially happened with Comic Sans.
So, Stephen, what are we going to see next? If you're hoping to see peak hipster, you're hoping to see artificially intelligent font, what are the trends? Are we going to swing straight back to single lines and austerity, you think?
I'm Well, I'm not too sure what will happen, but I really hope that we will see actually a broader range of sort of typographic experience. I'd rather it be about range rather than a particular style, because I think that really sets us up against this whole polar opposite thing that I was talking about. It just begins to ping pong, you know, back and forth and back and forth. I think the whole technological aspect of it could be really, really interesting.
I'm going to try and use a third font at some point this week just to show that I'm out there and daring. Stephen and Gemma, thank you both for your time.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Stephen Bannum's a typography expert and founder of Letterbox in Melbourne, and Gemma O'Brien's an artist and designer of handwritten fonts. And the writing's on the wall. If you have a favourite, post it to the Blueprint for Living website. You can only do it in ABC-approved fonts. You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN across the Asia Pacific on Radio Australia or somewhere else altogether via the internet, the podcast, or the ABC Radio app.